you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
You have entered the Twilight Histories, an audio adventure that casts you as the hero. Today, our Bronze Age Summer Rumble will continue with a daring story by Josh Hutchins. As the world crumbles, a tribe lost to history struggles to carry the flickering light of civilization against great waves of violence and destruction. When you're done listening to this story, make sure you join us on Patreon, where Josh is launching a massive bonus track just for our supporters. And now, listen to Shekalish by Josh Hutchins.
Some events in history, like the Dark Ages, the bubonic plague, the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria, and the Little Ice Age. These events had a stagnating effect on humanity, insofar as the advancement of technology, culture, and trade. Other events and eras, like slavery under the Roman Empire, slavery in the New World, Mongol conquest, and, to a great extent, communism, stunted humanity in ways we still have difficulty measuring. But even greater than these was the collapse at the end of the Bronze Age. Great empires like the Egyptians and the Hittites fell before, well, we really don't know what happened at the end of the Bronze Age. There are records of drought and famine, war, great migrations, civil uprisings, piracy, plagues. When humanity reached its peak during the Bronze Age, civilization entered a steady downward spiral. Records of this period are very few. For more than two centuries, cities were burned, and the practice of recording history practically vanished. Please choose some clothing from the shelves behind you while I continue your briefing. We are sending you to a world very similar to our own, at the time of the Bronze Age collapse. You are going to the island of Sicily in the Mediterranean. Of course, it isn't called Sicily, it's called Shekalish. The island is under the loose rule of a petty chief king of sorts, by the name of Tejesh. Although Shekalish isn't a vassal of the Egyptian Empire, King Tejesh does answer to the pharaoh's requests. Many peoples of the time did. Our agent has made arrangements with a man named Vibor. He's an advisor to King Tejesh. He has large amounts of land being farmed by slaves and servants, and you'll be managing them. I know it doesn't sound glamorous, but neither did a gong farmer either, and we all know how that worked out. Besides, Vibor has a habit of bringing his top servants with him to important meetings before the king, so you'll be privy to some interesting information. Based on your past world splits, I think you're really going to enjoy this. Now, let me look you over. Yes. A long yellow tunic with a wide leather belt at the waist. Very simple. These were simpler times. The feathered hat is a nice bit too, though you may wish to carry it for the time being, rather than wear it around. Based on ancient hieroglyphs and writings, we think the Shekalish wore feathered hats into battle. You'll figure it out. If you have no questions, please step onto the platform, and we'll get you on your way. As you know, you'll feel disoriented at first, but your senses will return to you soon. One last thing. We don't know much about the culture of Shekalesh, but what we do know is that they were listed as one of the sea peoples who attacked Egypt and vanished afterwards. You can handle yourself. Good luck. You wait to the sound of a crowing rooster. The orange bulge of the sun is just beginning to show above the eastern horizon on the sea. It rained last night, so the valley between you and the bay is coated with a frothy layer of fog. The air is crisp. The dull red coals of the fire in the nearby stone hearth are still just visible under a blanket of gray ashes. You roll yourself upright onto your low wooden bed and stretch, smelling leather and cedar. There's a rap on the doorway, and a slender man enters. Don't give me that look, Eshwa. When the sun gets up, I get up. You push your thin blanket onto the bed and stand, stretching some more. As always, my father, the rooster and I are in league with one another, conspiring to wake you before the great sun reaches its zenith in the sky. He smiles and gestures with one hand towards the door. Morning meal is ready. Minutes later, the two of you enjoy a breakfast of hard bread, tender goat meat slathered in butter, and a mild peppermint tea. You're joined by nearly 3 dozen others who sit on the ground with goat meat stuffed into their bread. Afterwards, they all brush their teeth with the frayed end of a stiff twig. You still aren't entirely accustomed to them copying everything you do. Eshwa, you say, and the man puts down his tea and looks at you. When you finish, set everyone to work on the same western edge of the north field, then bring Betty to my working shed. He squints. Betty? But we'll be using Betty in the field. You can spare her for a short while. I have something I want her to try on. You smile and he shrugs. Yes, my father. He sips the last of his tea, bows, and turns to the others. He claps his right hand against his left forearm twice and holds both arms above his head. My people, he says, loud enough for them all to hear. They stop chewing and look to him, eager to hear his words. In less than 15 minutes, you and Eshwa are maneuvering a stout wooden cart into position behind Betty. She is the epitome of stoicism as she chews her cud, seemingly bored with the whole affair. Just a little closer. Good. See that strap there? You point to a spot near Betty's flank. Eshwa nods. Slide the handle into it. You gesture for him to stand back. Excellent work, my father, Eshwa says. You have built for us a new dung cart. He smiles at you. It's not an ordinary dung cart, Eshwa. Watch this. You reach down at the front of the cart and pull a thick oak pin out of its slot. Gently, the upper frame of the cart tips backwards. You give it a nudge and the far back touches the ground. Then you push it back down and replace the pin. His eyes bulge slightly. What do you think? You ask, holding your arms toward the cart like you're a game show host. Rocks, he says, looking at it with his hand to his stubbled chin. You nod. Dung? He asks, looking at you. You nod again. We use it today, my father. He turns to 2 young boys standing nearby watching. Take Betty and this magnificent tilting dung cart to the north field. He claps his hand and forearm. They lead Betty away. You know, my father, Eshwa starts, looking at you over his shoulder, you do not need to keep making things. We are not complete invalids. He shrugs, smiles, and scratches his rear with a stump of a hand. I should have a better estimate on the number of bushels we can expect after I see how much field we clear this week. My father, you say, walking briskly in a wide dirt path through the heart of a bustling village. He takes long, smooth strides, with his hands clasped behind his back. He turns his head only slightly to look at you. You forget yourself. You forget your position with me. I care not how many bushels of grain they produce, so long as it is sufficient to feed me and my household. For now, he gives you a quick glance. That includes you. You see the wisp of a smile on his lips. His long green tunic makes subtle, soft sounds as he begins walking up the hill, with you struggling to match his pace. It would be easier for them to work if they had two hands, my father. He says with a shrug. Another man would have whipped you for saying such a thing. You feel your chest tighten and goosebumps on your arms. Such as it is, he continues, and because you've been remarkably helpful for the last month, I'll explain something to you. He stops and faces you. Others in the street veer away and give you and the man a broad berth. One woman, carrying a basket with three chickens stuffed into it, gives you a look of, what, pity? Sadness? I'll only say this once, your master says. Eshwa and those other half-wits I took from Egyptus are not here to grow grain. They are here as punishment. Growing grain is merely a useful bonus to me. I had their hands removed to prevent them from becoming a threat to me or to the king. He looks back towards his house and farm where you and he left a mere 10 minutes ago. One more thing. He leans in closer. Tell that worm, Eshwa, that if he speaks to Samoon again, I'll have his other hand as well, along with his tongue. He leans back and stares at you, clearly awaiting a response. Yes, Master Vibor, my father, I will see to it. He gives a curt nod and continues his walk. The activities in the village fade to the back of your mind as you picture Eshwa with no hands and no tongue. The sharp smell of smoke wakes you from your thoughts. You and Vibor enter a spacious flat clearing. At its center is a large stone structure with a dome, which looks as if it's been plastered over and made smooth, then painted a bright aqua blue. Squared timbers jut from the top edge of the walls, just below where the dome begins. The walls are painted orange, green, and white with strange geometric designs on them. Nearby, a pig is being roasted on a spit. Several people have gathered around and appear to be praying, or maybe they're singing. Inside, Vibor starts. Then he cuffs you on the ear to get your attention. Oh, my apologies, my father. You must control your thoughts if you are to control the world around you, he says, brushing dust from his sleeves. As I was saying earlier, when we go inside, do not speak unless either I or Tejesh speaks to you. I do not expect that to happen, but nor do I wish you to make a fool of me. He squints. Do you understand? Yes, my father, you say, nodding. But why are you bringing me here at all, if you're concerned about my behavior? He smiles. Because if, for any reason, I may be absent from here, I expect you to stand in as the king's advisor. He gives a conspiratory look from side to side. Because I do not want others, someone unknown to me, to take my place. You nod in understanding, then follow close behind him as he approaches the front door of the building. A large, heavy leather curtain is pulled aside by an older man sitting on a stool nearby. The man greets us with a whistly voice. Pyborg gives him a very slight bow and enters. Inside, the room is lit by open windows you didn't notice from the outside. A shaft of light, teeming with motes of dust, shoots down from an orifice at the top center of the dome, coating the dirt floor in an alien-looking white glow. A large man wearing a gray skirt, with his torso bare, stands near a sidewall with his back to you. "Tejesh, my father," Vibor says with a short bow. You mimic him and make a bow as well.
"Thy timing is impeccable, 'tis always, Vibor."
"I offer my apologies, my father. My servant and I will leave you in peace to finish relieving yourself." Tejesh grunts.
"No, 'tis fine."
His shoulders seem to shiver.
"I was just finished."
He turns to face you both, smoothing the wrinkles on the front of his skirt. A man steps from a corner of the room, picks up the low pot the man had just been urinating into, and carries it out a back door. Vibor follows the man with his eyes.
"Ah, carrying my filthy pot outside. 'Tis a task none of thine folk then thus accomplish. Do ye wish now that you had spared all those hands?"
He smiles a toothy grin. Vibor shrugs. "As I said, my father, your safety and the endurance of the people of Shekelesh are more important to me than the productivity levels of my slaves. I would do the same again if faced with a choice." Tejesh gives his own shrug, then squints his eyes at you. "My father, I'm sorry," you say, a bit of a panic touching your voice. You quickly lower your eyes.
"Such decorum. 'Tis for every day, but not this day."
He stretches his neck and repeats,
"Not this day."
"My father," Vibor says.
"Pisan and Tikal should join us anon. I have summoned them moments before you arrived. We have a message from Sheridan."
Vibor's eyes bulge, and he looks around the room. "My father, when you said my timing was impeccable, did you mean a jest?"
"'Twas indeed,"
he smiles. Then he turns to you again.
"This day, young servant, do not shy away from meeting my eyes. Today is a day of light and dark. Today is a day of action, a choosing day. I dare not make choices for my people without the courage of meeting their eye."
You slowly raise your head and lift your eyes, meeting his gaze. "Yes, my father," you say. You hear muffled voices from outside the door. A tanned woman throws the leather curtain aside and enters the room with a flourish. "My father," she says, giving a low bow, and her brown flowing skirt just touches the floor. Her dark hair is curly and pushed up in a loose bun at the back of her head, with several tresses dangling loosely.
"No,"
Tejesh says, holding his arms out flatly. He gives a sideways look at Vibor, with a fierce glint in his eyes.
"This day it is, my king."
The woman raises her head, the whites of her eyes expanding violently. "My king?"
"My king?"
Vibor echoes with a slight quaver in his voice. Tejesh nods and places his hands on his hips and exhales.
"Yes, today I am King Tejesh, for we are at war."
"My king," the woman shouts and bows again, her voice nearly reverent. Another person enters. He's dressed in a blue tunic with a strange scarf around his neck. He walks next to the woman and gives a weak bow. "My father," he says. The woman slaps him on the arm.
"He is king today, not father. If you had been timely, you would know."
The man scowls, rubbing his arm. King Tejesh holds out both his hands toward the woman.
"Pisan, my daughter, stand beside me this day."
He turns to a servant in a nearby corner and gives a curt nod.
I do not understand, Vibor says.
Nor do I, my king,
the other man says with a rasp.
Sheridan has come with a message from Pharaoh of Egyptus,
Tejesh says as he leads Passan to sit on a nearby low bench. He turns back to the man in the blue scarf.
To call,
he says, and points to the empty spot on the bench next to Passan. Takal has an uneven step when he walks, and he slowly lowers himself onto his seat, giving Passan a sideways glare.
Where is your mask, my brother? This cloth around your chin fails the work of hiding your face, Passan says, without even looking at him.
The leather curtain at the front opens again, and a large man wearing a red tunic enters. He carries a burnished metal helmet under his arm with long metallic horns protruding from the crest.
Thank you for water and wine, King Tejesh, the man says, smiling. And you are king, yes? I am king, just as you are king in Sheridan this day. Are you not?
The man nods.
I am.
He walks to stand just inside the circle of pale light.
Then we sail for Egyptus and answer the call of the Pharaoh.
Tejesh nods and turns to Vibor.
Send out the call, Vibor. 10,000 we can summon, but will 10,000 answer? By my word, in 3 days, we sail for Egyptus.
Passan moves to kneel next to the king and holds up her hands.
Oh, my king, I beg thee, take me to Egyptus. Let me serve you as you answer Pharaoh's call. Let us spill blood together.
Tejesh looks down at her, with a smile crinkling the skin around his eyes.
So fierce. You have the courage of 5 men, my beautiful Passan, but you do not have the strength of arms of 5 men. If you made war alongside me, it would be the greatest honor of my life. But, behold, your new husband would not be well pleased if you were injured.
She looks up at him with a wrinkle between her eyebrows.
New husband?
Sheridan steps forward and holds a hand to her.
Our 2 islands are joined by our union. Our firstborn shall rule them both.
She looks from Sheridan to Tejesh, each smiling and nodding in reply. Then Tejesh looks at Takal.
My son,
he says, with a strange dissatisfaction in his voice. Takal slowly stands and shuffles closer. Then he too kneels.
Thy face is a shadow to mine. But you too will answer the call of the Pharaoh.
Yes, my king,
Takal says, looking at the floor. Tejesh grabs Takal by the chin and lifts his head up sharply.
First, get thee to the far western shore of the island. On the way, summon and raise any able men for an army. If they have not a spear or a sword, I shall supply one to them. Return on the 3rd day. On that day we sail.
He lets go of Takal's chin and shoves him back by the top of his head.
Be gone, he shouts, and do not disappoint me again, my son.
Tejesh gently raises Passan by the hand and leads her to stand with Sheridan, who in turn holds her possessively. The king then turns to you and Vibor.
My greatest advisor and friend, he says, grasping Vibor firmly by the shoulder. Will you travel to Egyptus with me once more?
Vibor nods. Only death can stop me from doing so, he replies. Tejesh gives you a glance, then smiles at Vibor.
I would prefer thine servant to remain here, Basan is bold and strong, but she lacks the gift of patience. She could use his counsel.
Tejesh gestures at you, then continues.
My son,
he shakes his head.
He is all patience and nothing more. My dreams tell me.
We can call it whatever we want, Eshwa. He moves his head from side to side.
Yes, my father. But will it not still take many hours to split this tree into many parts? So many?
Yeah, but the planks will all be the same width. And they aren't splitting the tree, they're cutting it. This is much better and faster. Also, there will be fewer splinters. Eshwa crosses his arms, looking down at the two men pushing and pulling a bronze saw back and forth through a long section of tree.
Very well, he says, exhaling heavily. Now, if you would be so kind as to explain again your idea for harnessing the power of the river to do work for us.
You and Eshwa walk towards the village at the edge of Vibor's lands, cresting a small bare hill. You stop and turn, putting your hands on your hips. Do you ever just stop and look at that? You ask, gesturing with your chin. Eshwa looks over his shoulder.
It is most lovely, yes, and terrifying. Much like looking into a dark pool of water.
Ha, yeah. I think it's called Mount Etna.
Aket,
he says, and you nod. After a minute or two, you both walk to the bank of the river. You explain how you want to dam a small portion of the river where it drops and flows fast and build a stone building for a watermill there. By harnessing the power of the river, you tell him you intend to mill flour, operate a bellows, and saw wood. While you're explaining to Eshwa how a crew of one-handed people will be able to operate the devices, you hear an unnatural rustling in the nearby forest. Eshwa snaps his attention towards it also.
Who's there?
You shout, as you place one hand on the oaken cudgel at your side.
Who? Who? By the gods. You ask more questions than any man I will ever know.
The small frame of a woman steps into the clearing nearby you. After a sigh, you relax. You both give a small bow of respect. Lady Simoon, you say, rising from your bow. Eshwa remains bent at the waist. You may rise, she says, in her gentle voice. Then she smiles at you both.
What foolishness are you two planning now?
You detect the faint scent of flowers, and you turn and gesture to the river. It's something to help do the work faster. She looks down her nose at it and turns her eyes to you.
And what if you die?
Die?
Ladies, you heard me. What if one of you, or both, died? How would we continue this project without you? What's more, how would we operate it with you gone?
You and Eshwa exchange glances.
I guess I'll have to show several people how to finish it, and how to operate...
Clays! Clays, you fools. Scrolls. Can you not draw the instructions on such things?
Oh. Well, yes, I can do that. You nod. She smiles again with a satisfied look on her face.
In Egyptus, before I was brought to this island, Shekelesh, my father's father, Tulum, spoke words which lay upon the papyrus. When I was just a girl, I listened to a man from Cana speak the words from his mysterious talking clays.
She mimics the motion of holding a clay tablet and reading from it.
Would it not be beneficial for us to do such a thing?
To do what? Print books? A slight wrinkle forms between her eyebrows.
Books?
You shrug. I mean, you think we should, draw the words on the clay tablets here too? You make a gesture of pressing a reed into the soft imaginary clay in your hand. She nods.
More than that. I think we should draw all of our knowledge onto the clay tablets and keep them safe in a place where everyone can come to read them.
Sure, like the Great Library of Alexandria. She smiles and frowns at the same time.
The great what of what?
You give yourself a small chuckle. A library is a place where books are stored. Well, clays and scrolls of papyrus. She nods.
And what is an Alexandria?
It's nothing. You wave your hands. You're talking about building the great library of Shekelesh, right? She gives an approving nod, then raises her eyebrows.
I suspect, however, that Vibor will not approve.
She continues to smile.
So if we are to build such a thing, it must be done discreetly, you say.
And it must not interfere with the other work,
Eshwa adds. Samoon nods.
However, my father, I see one tiny problem.
Eshwa faces you.
I do not know how to speak the words from the talking clays.
Do you? He puts his hand on his hip. You squeeze your lips together and arch both your eyebrows.
Looks like I'm developing an alphabet for the Shekelesh language while I'm here, you whisper to yourself.
Yes, you say aloud to them. Passan is shouting so loud you can hear it from outside the domed building. You pull the leather flap aside from the door and enter, stamping the mud from your bare feet.
You're a fool, Tikal. Those who don't obey the summons of our father deserve death. Our father is king,
Passan shouts, pointing a finger at Tikal, who's sitting on a stone seat with his head resting on one of his hands.
Father, don't invoke our father, Tikal. He is not here. You should be gone as well, she snaps.
Our father left you here, dear sister. I, however, was not left here. I was merely unable to return in time to board father's ship.
Passan throws up her hands.
That was your fault too.
You clear your throat and Passan snaps her eyes at you.
Oh, look, your advisor is here now. Psh.
If I am intruding, you start, bowing your head slightly.
Nonsense,
Tikal says, smiling at you.
Vibor and my father ask that you advise me. I am now in great need of your counsel.
He waves you to approach. You step towards them. The storm outside increases and scattered raindrops cause the small fire to hiss and spit. What seems to be the... Passan faces you with her hands on her hips.
Men from the western portion of the island refuse to answer Pharaoh's call to arms.
She turns to face Tikal.
In open defiance of our father, the king.
I know this, Passan.
Then do something.
You have instructed me to do something many times now. What exactly do you suggest?
Tikal glares up at her.
Something, but you choose to do nothing.
Perhaps, you say, Tikal wants to avoid making a bad situation worse.
That may be, but this isn't what Tikal is doing. He simply doesn't want to act. He is afraid of our father's disapproval,
Passan says, with a smile turning up one side of her mouth. Tikal glares and walks to a nearby stone table and pours wine into a clay cup. How many men are we talking about, you ask? Tikal shrugs.
No more than 20. Maybe as few as 3. I'm Not sure.
See? Passan shouts, holding her hands toward Takal, then letting them drop to her sides. Only 3 men!
Or 20, you say.
20 is a great many, considering we have no more than 5 in the city right now. You turn to Takal. And what are these men doing presently?
Right now, he smiles, I have no idea. Tilling the ground, fishing, sleeping, I don't know. But whatever they are doing, I can tell you what they are not doing. They are not on ships sailing for Egyptus alongside my father.
You should assemble every strong man at your command and march westward, Passan barks. And do what, you snap? Passan points a slender finger at you. Watch your tongue with me. My father is king. You do not want me to speak ill of you in his ear when he returns.
Vibor and my father told me of your skill with a blade,
Takal interrupts.
I have watched you myself when you practice. I say there is no one, man or woman, who could match you.
You give a polite bow. That may be true. I have learned many things over my years, many of them with a sword in my hand, many of them at sword point. And if these 10, 20, or 3 men were to attack me each in turn, we may have a chance. I doubt they will do such a foolish thing, however, which means my skills would be wasted. You exchange glances with them.
What do you suggest?
Takal says. Perhaps a duel, Passan blurts out, barely holding back her laughter. You can scarcely refrain from slapping your own forehead. Sure, I'll do it. Passan stiffens. I didn't mean you. She jerks her chin at Takal. I mean him, my dear brother, ferocious and deadly as a lion.
As a lion? I seriously doubt that, a man says with a streak of sarcasm in his tone.
He swaggers into the room, the pale light casting shadows in his sharp facial features. He begins tapping a crooked sword against his thigh.
Lord Takal here couldn't even muster the courage to raise his voice in my presence, much less fight me.
He smiles again.
I'm here to remind you, Lord Takal, that I do not answer to you or to your father. The entire army of Shekelesh has sailed to Egyptus, eh?
Then there is no one here to protect you. He looks at you and sniffs. Then he strides towards Takal. You reach over your shoulder, looking for the sword that sat there for years. Nothing. You hold your hand there, as if grasping an invisible sword hilt. That's close enough, you bark. He stops and licks you up and down. His lips ooze into a smile, which touches his eyes with a hint of madness.
Oh, and what if I don't think it is? What if I decide I want to run this blade through his guts?
He gestures with the point of his sword towards Takal.
Then carry her home over my shoulder.
He points his chin at Passan.
I must merely walk over your cold, limp body. You can't stop me. You are but one man.
You level a glare at him. You are welcome to test that assumption at your earliest convenience, you snarl. 2 other men walk in to flank the man. They have shaven heads and broad chests.
These are my brothers, Nadine and Natan.
He beams at you, but his eyes scream murder. And what is your name?
I am Spag. So you will know who killed you.
3-on-1. Very brave. They'll sing songs of you this day. You glance at the floor. And my name is... You kick a large lump of sand and ash into Spog's face. He tries to block it with his hands, and he takes several steps away, reeling.
In the process, he drops his crooked sword. You tuck and roll forward, snatching up the blade and swinging it back in a wide arc. The sound of bronze on flesh rings its familiar tune in your ears. You dart to the side, just out of reach from a heavy sword blow. Spog regains his composure. One of the two men, Nadine, or Natan, you don't really care, is down on a knee, holding both hands to a deep cut on the back of his thigh. Blood is already running down his leg and splattering on the dusty floor. You swing the sword around a couple of times, trying to loosen up your wrists and get a feel for its balance. Natan! Spock shrieks, looking at the injured man. Your years in Britannia and on the Saxon-Roman frontier taught you to strike when you see such hesitation from the enemy. Nadine jumps back and swings wildly, but you turn your attack on him into a feint as you flex and turn the point towards Spog. The blade cuts several inches into the meat of his side. A hard swing upward separates Natan's right hand from his arm. You carry the upward arc into a downward one and bury the sword into the neck of Spog. Blood hisses out of his jugular and he drops to his knees. Nadine swings at you clumsily. It's so clumsy that you barely parry the blow. It cuts a long, shallow line across your left forearm. You can tell this man is strong from years of manual labor, but he knows nothing of a sword fight. The first rule of sword fighting is that there are no rules. Secondly, calling it a sword fight puts a person in the wrong frame of mind. It's not a sword fight. It's just a fight. You happen to both have swords, but you can use anything. You stomp Nadine's toe with your heel. He yelps. You slap him flat across his cheek with your free hand. He stumbles back, and you swipe the tip of the sword downward across his shin. The bronze kisses the bone. You crouch and lunge forward, kicking one leg back for balance. His lumbering swing flies over your head. The point of your blade finds the soft skin of his inner thigh. There's so much blood on the sword, you can't tell how far it's penetrated his flesh. He falls completely back and drops his sword, clutching his leg. You stand and quickly examine each of them, watching for signs of further resistance.
Are they dead?
Passan says, holding her hands over her mouth. You point the sword at Spog. He is. Then you gesture to Natan and Nadine. They will probably live, but they'll have a few nasty scars. You turn and face Takal and Passan. When you said you wanted me to fight a duel, I didn't know you meant right now.
Make way! A man shouts. Make way for the king!
A throng of people moves along with a small clutch of men, carrying someone in a large litter.
Make way!
The man repeats in a hoarse voice. Several people along the way weep aloud. A long line of soldiers makes its slow way behind them all. In the distance, the red sunset casts its glow on the sea's ripples, making it appear a sea of blood. A man wearing a green cloak strides up to you and grabs you by the shoulder.
My father, Master Vibor? You manage to stammer out. His eyes are wild, and his voice is tremulous and low.
We must speak. We must speak now, but not here.
That was Shackleish by Josh Hutchins. If you enjoyed this show and you want to hear more, Josh has just launched a huge epic bonus show just for you and all of our supporters on Patreon. The moment you sign up, you'll get instant access not only to the bonus show, but also to all of the huge library and bonus shows going back to 2011. And you'll get early access to all of our shows that you hear from this podcast. For instance, we just launched The Ruin of King Ad by Kevin Valbanese. It takes place in the Arabian Peninsula, where the gods rule ancient kingdoms. All Patreon funds go right back to supporting the podcast. So when you sign up as a patron, you will really help build this show. Please go to Patreon and run a search for The Twilight Histories, or go to the website and click through to the Patreon link. That's twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to The Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.